talk about preparing, well, if you're doing state tomography, you're trusting your apparatus, and if you're doing tomography of an operation, you're trusting your states and measurements. There's always something that we're trusting is somehow perfectly characterized. So what can we do if, in sort of a, in a black box way, when we buy our apparatus from somebody we don't necessarily trust, what can we really trust in that sense? And then in some sense, that's what physics and science is somehow built, that no one gave us apparatus and told us what it did. We somehow developed trust in our apparatus that we have today over the years. I'm basically going to talk about self-testing, how tomography fits in with that. This is joint work I've done over the years with a number of collaborators. These are the most recent works. There's also some earlier work by Van Damme, also including Van Damme and Santa that I'm going to mention. So our motivation for testing and for self-testing, well, one of them is cryptography. So for example, if you want to buy an apparatus for implementing your cryptographic protocols, a simple example, let's say BB84, you want to be able to provide four input bits, four input strings, and get four output states which have a specific inner product relation. We don't actually care what these states are. We don't care if they're coherent states or single photons. Essentially, for the purpose of the protocol, as long as you can give me four states living in some two-dimensional vector state space with this same inner product relations, corresponding measuring apparatus, we're happy. So you can buy something that'll do this and appear to do this, but you maybe shouldn't trust it, because what if the apparatus is in some other degree of freedom? It could be anything, even a degree of freedom you don't know about, but very often it'll be a degree of freedom you do know about. It leaks information, which basically makes these four states orthogonal. It tells you which of the four states you're sending. And in fact, these are called side channels. The first sort of proof of concept implementation of QKD had such a side channel because you could hear the Pockel cells or something, so you could actually hear which bases is being used. And so these were, it's very easy to compromise this system. But there's more sophisticated side channel attacks, such as the timing information. There's other degrees of freedom as well that you need to worry about. And we're kind of looking for tests that don't involve understanding and trusting the physics of a system. We want it to be as black box as possible. So we'd like, whatever assumptions we do make, and there'll always be some, we'd like some clearly stated assumptions and some well-defined testing procedures that we should be using in such a cryptographic protocol. And the goal, the self part of self-testing, is that we don't want to rely on some other untrusted apparatus. So that kind of makes the problem a bit trivial. If there's some apparatus that you trust, well, then that is capable of doing a tomography, then the problem is solved by tomography. Some other early related work done by, well, mathematicians and computer scientists. This is, Edelman is the A in RSA, by the way. A very mathematical foundational paper on computability. And if you read part of it, you'll see that one of their models of quantum computation has a component where the rotation angle, the quantum, the phase rotation angle, is unknown, and the computer does a tomography of itself, and then proceeds to do whatever computation you asked it to do. It's a universal computer where it's basically its only quantum component is unknown, and it does a tomography of it and then continues to implement the computation. So there's a it's a cool connection. I'm not going to talk about this. So for the purposes of crypto, Myers and Yao developed a scheme for self-testing their sources. Very simple set of tests. Suppose you had a black box that outputs EPR pairs, or alleged EPR pairs. And suppose that Alice and Bob, in sort of two spatially distinct locations, you're doing one of three random projective measurements. what they proved is that if the statistics you get are consistent with the maximally entangled state, then up to local unitaries, you do have a maximally entangled state in there. Right? And importantly, the projections are consistent with measuring the EPR pair, this sort of virtual EPR pair. So it's physically in there somewhere. So what I mean is, if you get the right statistics, you know that this EPR, this black box, outputs some state, which up to local unitaries, gives you indeed that EPR pair. Tensor product, other stuff. The other stuff could be entangled stuff between Alice and Bob, so it could be additional EPR pairs, for example. But these measurements that you're doing are effectively just measuring this EPR pair in the correct basis up to those local unitaries. Right? These local unitaries work on this as well as the ancilla, but it's local. Just the UA is just on the A part and the UB is just on the B part. So if you're trying to do secure, prepare, and send crypto, for example, you use this, and you've characterized this box. Then when you do a random measurement here, say you get a zero, you'll know that on the other side, what you have is a zero tensor some generic state up some isometry, some unitary. And if you get a one, then you have one tensor the same state up to modulo the same unitary. This is really just a reference frame. It's not a big deal. So you really are preparing the four BB84 states with no other information. In useful information in the other degrees of freedom. This is
a consequence of their work on QKD.
And there's some assumptions. They're assuming locality, or there's many ways to phrase it. They just basically say that the measurements at A commute with the measurements at B. There's no sort of, they're not necessarily space-like separated, but they're separated, and you're trusting that there's no signaling or any kind of correlation, secret communication going on between the Alice and Bob end. If you're really paranoid, you space-like separate. Of course, they assume that the black box, not of course, but that it's doing the same thing over time. Or I guess there's ways of reducing assumption too, using Definetti theorems. And they're also trusting their classical apparatus. You have to have some kind of assumption like that, because if you don't believe that you're counting the statistics correctly, then you're in big trouble. So these fairly reasonable and almost necessary assumptions. The results weren't robust. And robustness isn't such a straightforward thing to prove. And you also want efficient robustness, because you'll never be able to guarantee these statistics exactly. You'll only be able to guarantee them to within some epsilon. So when you get the statistics with an epsilon, what does that promise you? And how close are you to the actual states? Is it epsilon? Is it 10th root of epsilon? What is it? So robustness is necessary. And my guess is that if you want to do secure under these very strong very weak assumptions, if you want some sort of verifiable, secure, prepare and send BB84, you'll probably need to do something like this. So why else would you want to test some untrusted apparatus? So there's cryptography, and BB84 is one protocol, but you could imagine any cryptographic protocol where you have to prepare some state, and Alice sends it to Bob, and you need some sort of inner product relation between the states, for example. But suppose you want to do a quantum computation, or you're paying somebody to do the quantum computation for you. And the answer isn't efficiently checkable on a classical computer. Why should you trust this result? So suppose you have one of these, you solve one of the Clay Institute million-dollar problems, but your proof is of the form, if this quantum algorithm outputs a 1, the conjecture is true, and if it outputs a 0, it's false, something like that. Or if it outputs a 50-50 distribution, it's true, and whatever. So something like that. And then somebody's allegedly running the quantum algorithm to prove it. Why should you believe that that was a faithful execution of the quantum algorithm?
So in this case, we don't care about inter-product relations. For cryptography, we want those four BB84 states to really be no more distinguishable than they're supposed to be. Here we don't care. All we care is that we have the correct statistics. But so sometimes you will want actual unitary equivalents to the right thing. Other times you just want to be guaranteed that you're getting the correct statistics. So earlier on, almost 10 years ago, with Vendem and Magnez and Santa, we developed a series of self-tests for a universal and fault-tolerant set of quantum gates. So just three or four gates, but we had additional assumptions. We assumed that we could use the same Hadamard gate twice in the same circuit and that it was doing the same thing. We assumed you could prepare and measure zeros and ones faithfully. These two assumptions weren't a big deal, really. The big assumption was we assumed that the physical system was a two-state system, that our qubits were actual qubits, which is a huge assumption because it really limits the conspiracies possible. So we'd like to remove those three assumptions. But we'd like to do it, and the cool thing about what we did was once you test these few components with these strong assumptions, then you could execute an arbitrarily large circuit and know that it was being faithfully executed. So while we want to remove these assumptions, because they're not, in most cases, physically realistic, we still want an efficient procedure. I don't want to have to do 2 to the n work to test an n gate circuit, for example, because then you're kind of defeating the point of doing the quantum computation. So we want something where we're doing a polynomial amount of work, just testing the components and making sure they're working together correctly. So this is where the unitary equivalence comes in. We don't necessarily care about unitary equivalence, but it gives us a way of doing composable, so efficient testing. The main idea is to combine the EPR style self-testing of Myers and Yao with our gate testing approach. So suppose you want to test a gate G. So first do the EPR, the Myers-Yao EPR test. Then stick a G along one of the branches, your gate G, and then repeat measurements. Here you're preparing one of 6 random states. There you're getting statistics on the output. So when you measure something here, you know what's going into G. You measure statistics after G, you're doing a tomography of G. If the statistics are correct, then you've actually implemented something that's locally unitarily equivalent to the ideal gate. This isn't composable. Suppose you test G and then you do the same idea to test another gate H. There's no reason to believe. Right? So you can then prove that you really have done a G and H up to some local unitaries. It doesn't mean that if you then go and execute this algorithm, you've executed G and H composed. Right? Because all you've done is tested the behavior of H on what comes immediately out of this EPR box. You haven't tested what H does and what that projector does on a photon that's gone through this box G first. Because this could completely change the Hilbert space of the system, and H could be programmed to do something completely different on qubits that go through the gate G. So in this very paranoid environment, you have to assume that in classical side channels is a complete description of the history of the qubit. Everything that was ever done to it is there. And this, more or less, can actually occur in real, and to some extent, occur in real systems. So we haven't done enough here. Remember, we want something which will test the whole circuit. We want to somehow just test the parts and know that together they've implemented the whole circuit. I don't want to do a tomography of some n qubit circuit. So suppose, as a toy example, we have this simple circuit. But in reality, we could think of an n-qubit circuit with many 1 and 2 qubit gates. Actually, 1-qubit gates are irrelevant because they could be absorbed into the next operation. But for the purposes of explaining the technique, I'll talk about 1-qubit gates. So how do you prove that this thing that you're actually executing is equivalent approximately to some ideal circuit you want to implement? So the assumption is we have some sort of classical control mechanism that's, you know, telling the source to output qubits or preparing them, controlling which gates get applied to which qubits. So you want to do this gate like this. It's being controlled by some classical computer. We trust the classical computer. And we trust that, you know, this, so for example, this qubit doesn't know what's happening to this qubit right now. It doesn't know because they're spatially separated. We're assuming that they don't know. So they can, these two qubits could have conspired in advance and have some shared entanglement and all sorts of classical strategies. But at this point, they don't know whether this laser is being shined. This qubit doesn't know what's happening to that qubit. And so on. Or alternatively, in a different apparatus, you know, this classical computer can be controlling the parameters of this one qubit gate and that one qubit gate and this two qubit gate. Right? But this gate doesn't know what's happening there, and it doesn't know what's going to happen in the future either. These are the kind of physical assumptions we're making. So again, we want to have some system like this where the classical computer is controlling the parameters of all the gates, and we somehow want to trust that. But otherwise, these gates could be completely conspiring against us in terms of their execution. So the original paper with Van Damme and Santa and Magnez, we just tested each component and then just assumed they would work faithfully in a larger circuit. That won't work in this more paranoid environment, because basically you can have this side channel which keeps track of the history of each qubit. So if there's a finite set of tests, the qubits can keep track of their history, and at some point, if you're doing an arbitrarily large computation, the qubits will realize that this is no longer part of a test. And if they know they're not being tested, well, then they can do whatever they like and you'll never detect it. So you can program your apparatus to behave when they know, when they might be under a test, but when they know they're not being tested, then they're in trouble. So the key to spot checking things is that you're supposed to not know when you're being tested or not.
This metaphor?
Yeah. So the hint here was that every circuit you might want to implement has to be also part of the test you might be executing. So again, suppose we want to run this simple circuit, but this generalizes to an arbitrarily large circuit with two qubit gates. The main observation, one of the tools of properties VPR pairs we're going to use is that you have this particular entangled state and you apply U and U star, you get back the same EPR state. So suppose I want to apply that three qubit gate. First of all, I verify two EPR pairs. So I do a series of experiments to verify that I have the two EPR pairs. Then I do a tomography test on the gates G1 and G2. Now I do this other test, which effectively is G star, G1 and G2 star. So this recreates two EPR pairs. And again, you know, these qubits are maximally entangled with those. So if they're still maximally entangled, we have basically defined a four-dimensional Hilbert space here on which we know what's happening. We don't know what's happening in all the other degrees of freedom. But on this Hilbert space defined by, you know, what you get when you measure a zero here, we found it was maximally entangled with some hidden qubit here. On that Hilbert space, we know what's going on. And now instead of being perfectly correlated with these, it's perfectly correlated with these qubits. So now we know the input. When we measure these guys here, we know what's going into G3. And we can do a tomography of G3 on this well-defined two-qubit space here, and so on. Then we can sort of, in some sense, undo what the action of G3. So now we have, you know, we can continue and repeat this for an arbitrarily large circuit. The important point is, if you count all the experiments I'm talking about doing, it's a polynomial amount. I'm just kind of growing the circuit I want to implement piece by piece. I only have to do a polynomial number of tests. So I'll give the exact complexities later.
Sorry.
Yep.
Could you go to that slide? Yeah. So why you are saying that this is going to go polynomial? Because if you increase the complexity of G3, you essentially...
I'm only ever going to do 1 and 2 qubit gates.
But you cannot do process tomography on G3 with...
Why not?
Yeah, I mean, if it is on n qubit.
No, but the circuit is n qubits, but I'm only going to... I'm only going to do 2 qubit gates at a time. So I'll first verify this guy, and then I'll reset it so I just have EPR pairs at this point, and then test this guy and then this guy.
Oh, okay.
So I grow it one gate.
But if they are supposed to create an n-body entanglement, a high entanglement among n qubits,
yeah.
There is no way you can test that by now.
Yes.
Mathematical proof for that?
Yes. That's
So you can, by single two-body, it's just, I don't see how you can extract the correlated information about, n-body qubits, because whenever you do these kind of things, you're extracting, some partial information which can be expressed in this kind of tensor product of the single and two-body terms.
If a circuit consists only of 1 and 2 qubit gates, and you can build multi-party entanglement out of just 2 qubit gates, and he knows that every element of the circuit works perfectly, then we know that he's produced the desired state, right?
If you know if they work perfectly, yeah.
I'm assuming that initially I have. So this doesn't even have to be independent. You just have a big black box which allegedly prepares 2 EPR pairs. Then we just test those. So now we know in this mystery this subspace we have 2 EPR pairs, and then we just continue to grow it little by little.
Yeah, if they work perfectly, yeah. But if they have some some finite errors, you get interference among these errors, which is not.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to discuss. We analyze the errors in robustness.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's a non-trivial result, and we have a paper on it. Yeah.
Does it assume you can do the G star, whatever the...
No, we don't assume that.
No, okay. So that's part of the characterization.
Yeah. If you don't...
The G tilde, what about it?
It's supposed to be equal to G star.
Yeah,
and we don't assume that it is. Okay. Just if it is, then this works, and if it isn't, it doesn't. Okay. And then you'll fail the test. In fact, it only has to be G star on that one qubit. You can do other stuff in the side channels.
Yeah, but you're just resetting.
Yeah, that's why I put the tilde, because it really just, it's doing G star on that one particular Hilbert space. Yeah.
Sorry, for the circuit you drew on the board. You actually, in principle, 2 qubit gates which are working together. Why do I only need to consider two output arms? How do you test the third one on the top? That is working properly together within the two bottom ones. Because there you're getting now 3 output or 4 output qubits.
We test this whole slice.
Yeah.
And we test that this guy, we test maximal entanglement here and here, and this guy and that guy. So
it's bootstrapping.
Yeah.
You'd have 4 EPR pairs.
Exactly. Yeah, we'd have 4 EPR pairs. So I'm just
4.
But it's
2 EPR pairs.
It's like
four.
Like this is a circuit you want to test. You have to have a complete copy of those qubits on the other side.
On one side, you're undoing the operations in order to test the next bit.
Oh, so you don't test it only with 2 EPR pairs. You test it, and you need as many EPR pairs as you have input line to the circuit.
Yeah. So I guess it wasn't obvious how to. People say 1, 2, dot, dot, dot. So this is how it's supposed to scale larger things. You just slowly build it up gate by gate.
So
I'm sorry, no, I'm still not.
Okay.
I'm still not seeing. You've got two inputs there, right? From your diagram on the board, it looks like to test that circuit, you need two EPR pairs.
Yes, so this is a 2-qubit gate, and I need two EPR pairs.
Now over on the left,
but here, if I have a 4-qubit gate, I need four EPR pairs. And on this side, I'm going to build up the star of the conjugate, not the conjugate. The conjugate. You do that so that you could efficiently continue to test the rest of the circuit. Because I don't want to be in the business of, you know, if I don't do this part, then I'm down here and I measure zeros and ones and I'm essentially doing a tomography of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be in the business of doing that because it's going to become exponentially hard, apparently, in general. So some important technical points. Our procedure only works if all the gates and states and measurements have real coefficients. And now please promise me that you only have real coefficients. All we're saying is that if you want me to self-test or implement in a self-tested way an algorithm that has complex imaginary parts, that we don't have a procedure that'll work. So we're not, but you know, fortunately, complexity theoretically, for every computation with complex coefficients, there's one with only real coefficients with a very modest overhead. So you can still implement Shor's algorithm or a proof of the Poincaré conjecture or whatever you want on a quantum computer using only real coefficients. You don't lose generality in that sense.
Sorry, I'm having your face. You're saying that, you're assuming that the ideal gates have only real coefficients.
Yeah.
But the faulty simulations might have anything.
Yeah, right. So it's not, this is not, we're not making an unrealistic assumption. It's an inconvenient assumption because we have to reduce everything to real circuits. But there's only a modest overhead in doing that if necessary. Now, it's not because we weren't trying hard enough or we didn't care. We wanted to, but so there's this well-known simulation, right? If you have n complex qubits, you can simulate them with n plus 1 real qubits. It's a very simple, it's not a unitary transformation, but there's a very simple mapping. So they're not equivalent according to our notion of equivalence. So for crypto, this could be a problem if this real simulation is going on. We also wanted equivalence because it helped our proofs work efficiently. We wanted this, it helped our composability results. But in crypto, you probably want equivalence for distinguishability reasons as well.
When you say a real qubit, you mean cos sine theta 0 plus cos theta 1 with no EDI. What do you mean?
Yeah.
Okay.
Where all the amplitudes can be positive or negative, but not imaginary. Not real as in your lab. Real, but, so again, our tools include two notions, simulation and equivalence. Simulation is talking about getting the right statistics. Equivalence is a stronger thing where we're saying you're locally, unitarily equivalent to what you think you have. And under the right conditions, simulation implies equivalence, and that's how we get our main results. So let me state it precisely. Suppose you have k gates, ideal gates, T1 up to TK. You want to run your circuit on some input string X, and you want it, you know, there's this precision parameters epsilon and gamma. So if this procedure I've sketched essentially, if it accepts, in other words, if it doesn't catch the apparatus cheating, then it means with high probability, 1 minus gamma, the probability distribution you get on the final measurements is within epsilon to the 1 over 8 k plus m, some constant, from the distribution you get by running the ideal gates. So if you want this to be constant, you'll notice that epsilon has to be an 8th power and 1 over k plus n to the 8th. So the number of experiments to achieve this is kn over epsilon. So I said epsilon is like inverse in an 8th power. So this is a 9th power polynomial in k and n. So it's not a nice polynomial, but it is a polynomial times some log factors. So from a complexity theoretic viewpoint, this is efficient. From an experimental viewpoint, this is not very good because that's a huge hit you have to take in terms of the precision you have to achieve in the lab.
versus the conclusions the theorems will give you in terms of how close you are to the ideal thing. So that's one thing we would like to improve if we want this to be efficient, to be practical. So let me elaborate on this, why we assume real versus we don't allow imaginary amplitudes. Because there's this well-known simulation I told you about where the imaginary part could be simulated by an extra qubit. If there's an I, the extra qubit is in the state 1, and if it's real, it's in the state 0. And there's a very simple bijection between measuring in this imaginary land versus in this real conspiracy land. If you want to measure in the computational basis here, you just measure the first qubit and you just ignore that conspiracy qubit. If you want to apply an X gate, you just apply an X gate to the first qubit. If you want to apply a phase shift, relative phase shift of I, you do a controlled XZ gate. And so all the mathematics works out. The problem, a potential problem with these imaginary amplitudes is that so the way the simulation works, it extends to n qubits, it's still just one extra qubit. Right? The bijection carries forward very naturally. But maybe there's a way to test against this conspiracy, because notice that this conspiracy qubit has to reside somewhere. So every time you do a gate on qubits, say, 1 and 2, you have to potentially use that conspiracy qubit, flip it or not. But it has to be physically located somewhere. So maybe we could do a test that tries to catch this conspiracy, because this qubit can't physically be everywhere at once. Because we're assuming locality, so this gate can't instantaneously move around. And it's not possible for two distant qubits to be interacting, for all the qubits to be interacting with one particular hidden qubit simultaneously. But we figured out a way to my PhD student, Matthew McKay, colleagues in Europe had found a similar result in order to explain this apparent mystery they kept finding with Bell inequalities, that they could always maximally violate these inequalities using real coefficients and real gates. So they had a similar simulation. But basically, this conspiracy qubit can be delocalized. It can be an entangled state amongst all the qubits, and you can locally update it and still be consistent. It wasn't easy to figure out how to get it to work, but it is possible to get it to work. So what does it mean? It means that no black box test, with the assumptions that we made, will be able to distinguish whether you have this complex world or this real simulation, this real conspiracy world. So if you're trying to come up with a test that's trying to do something like that, you should see if this conspiracy spoofs it or not. So whether you don't have to worry about it.
How much do you have?
Time?
Because we are using also the discussion.
Okay, I'm almost done.
Yeah.
3-4 minutes.
Let him finish, then we discuss. 5 minutes.
Okay.
If it's possible.
So
otherwise we have to be late.
So the simulation theorem, it's, from a computer science point of view, it just tells you something about the power of black box tests. It won't allow you to distinguish these real simulations from their complex counterparts without some additional assumptions. So some open problems in future directions. We'd like to eventually apply these to actual experiments, right? But in order to get these to work, you need detector efficiencies. If you want to use them on existing at the physical qubits we have today, they're not even close to being good enough, because we need really high detector efficiencies.
Right.
And reliable sources.
How high?
Well, like 99 point something, right? Because you need epsilon to be small. Because we're going to take epsilon to the 1/8.
Right.
Will kill you if epsilon is really small. Of course, you could wait till we have scalable quantum computing and then apply these techniques on the logical qubits. Then we're okay. But we don't have scalable quantum computing yet. But right now, this isn't good enough to work with the existing detector efficiencies. We could try to modify them and make some additional assumptions that we're just willing to accept about, our detectors aren't very good, but they're not bad, they're not evil. So if you could somehow mathematically formalize that, you might be able to come up with some test that allows you to work with
inefficient detectors, but that's non-trivial work to be done. We'd like to improve the asymptotics. N to the 9 is not a good polynomial. We could maybe bring it down to n to the 5 or something, or n to the 3 for specific applications at least. This is very related to the kind of security proofs that physicists are coming up with for certain types of QKD that are device independent. They're essentially the same type of thing. They're black box types of proofs where you don't care about the specific physical details of the devices. So there is a relationship we're trying to better understand. To some extent, they bypass the middleman. They don't, you know, and so you can use our tools to get you device independent security proofs, because we don't care about the details of the devices. We prove that somewhere in this, you know, in the universe, there is this EPR pair, and then therefore these statistics can be trusted. They kind of bypass the middle step of proving that there must be an EPR pair somewhere. But I think they're related, and we're looking at that. I'd also like to look at this in a more computer science paradigm of interactive proof systems, where we're the classical verifiers and the apparatus are the provers trying to convince us that they're faithfully implementing the quantum computation that we want them to implement. And we're the verifier somehow controlling how the provers interact. And yeah, that's the end. Thanks for your time.
I didn't want to interrupt. We have not much time. Few questions.
So, Daniel, if you teleport a qubit in this kind of pretty model, does the one that come out know anything about the history of the one you started, or is it just know that it's the output of the teleportation, basically?
Yeah, we're thinking of using teleportation as a way of laundering for just.
Yeah.
But you have to assume that. They could still have prior entanglement, but that is a way of enforcing that they are communicating at most one qubit. Yeah.
The EPR pair in the entanglement, and test that, obviously.
Yeah.
I guess I'm wondering if you do that, why you actually need even an infinite set of tests.
What do we need? Oh, I see. So we're thinking about, that makes it even less practical to implement these tools. But in terms of proving the existence of self-testable stuff, then that's something we can. We're looking at stuff like that.
Okay. Maybe you mentioned, but I missed it. So what does it tell us when we do this test for real number? You said it's indistinguishable from an actual device that working with imaginary coefficients.
If I said that, that's not correct. So if it's real, we can verify that a real thing is just the real thing and not a complex simulation. But the complex simulation could be faked by a real, a complex computation can be faked by a real simulation, which is not unitarily equivalent.
But if you
run our test on a real computation, then it is unitarily equivalent to that real computation.
Real, you mean real coefficients?
Yeah.
Okay. So in a practical sense, you cannot test the actual quantum computing algorithm that is implemented because you are dealing with, you know, imaginary coefficients.
No, so this is related to Daniel's point earlier. The system we assume is living in complex land, but it's unitarily equivalent to something that's implementing this real computation. So it could even have real coefficients, but there's a basis change which maps it to this real Hilbert space.
Is that with that delocalized Ancelot?
No, we don't use that. That conspiracy is just a way of proving we can't self-test complex imaginary computations with imaginary coefficients. That was just explaining why we didn't have any theorems about complex, self-testing complex computations.
Okay.
Because it's not possible. But our test is just, we don't do any of that.
You are saying that you can classically do a unitary transformation, map this computation with imaginary coefficients to a real one.
Yeah.
tested on the device,
yeah.
And that essentially is going to tell you that the device is working for the actual unitary transformation with imagery. I don't think
No. So I'm just saying, if say you want to implement Shor's algorithm on a computer you don't trust,
okay.
You would first translate it into a real computation,
mm-hmm.
And you would run that real computation in a test in a self-tested way. And so you know you're getting the right statistics.
But
we don't.
It's a different combination of single 2-qubit gates.
Yeah, it is.
So it's not going to tell you about really about the actual thing, the actual computation, because that's a different implementation.
Yeah, right. So but for that thing, we know we did that. We know we did the real computation up to local unitaries. But if you want me to verify that you're really doing a complex, you know, imaginary implementation of Shor's algorithm, you can't. There's nothing we can do in this framework.
It's fundamental.
Yes, that's what that weird conspiracy was showing.
But yeah, you know, that's, you know, I think it's very interesting, but it's very bad, you know, because I don't think that the information, those kind of process tomography for real thing, it's going to be a good evidence to say that, you know, I'm working, this device is really good for the actual algorithm.
Okay. The point is that you can run any algorithm you can run. Quantum computer, you can run using purely real coefficients.
Yeah, but the control parameters have like the L's changing with the changing the parameters. You have to test them with the actual parameters that they're running your algorithm.
Yes. The point is that we will never ever, when we build our quantum computers, use any complex parameters. Why would we have to? We can run any algorithm with real parameters.
Okay.
This device has been verified to work with real parameters.
Okay. I suggest to go on.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks very much.